Good morning. Today's interview is with Emma Park, who is a functional medicine nutritionist and a health professional educator. And today's topic is about gut and gut microbiomes. And so there's been a lot of talk about probiotics and some additional research on microbiomes. And thanks very much to the Catalyst program on the ABC presented by Dr. Joanna McMillan in February 2018. So your focus, Emma, has been on pregnancy and how the maternal microbiome impacts on the health of not only the mother but also the baby. So can you just tell us a little bit more and provide us a little bit more understanding of what microbiomes are and how important they are to our gut and certainly to our health?
Yeah, absolutely. So the term microbiome is indicates all of the microbes that live in and on us, not just bacteria, but also viruses, and there's parasites and funguses and yeast and those kind of, and the genetic material is what makes up the term the microbiome. We tend to think about it in context of the gut the most because the greatest concentration of those microbes lives in the gut, but there's also other body sites that have a high concentration of microbiome, and that microbiome has influence over the health of that body site. So the way it does that is it has this interaction with the immune system. So again, the majority of our immune system sits in our gut. That's why it has such that big influence over the immune system. So about 70% of our immune cells are actually in the lining of our small intestine. And then also that the other body sites that the microbiome in are influencing things like the metabolic processes, hormone levels, blood sugar balance, all these kind of things. So in that way, they have a great influence over our overall gut health and also our general health and well-being, and just the whole functionality of our body is really driven by the balance of our microbiome.
That's so interesting, because we do tend to forget about, we are really the product of what we eat, isn't it, really?
So really, with the microbiome, there's more microbial cells with their genetic material than there are human cells. So we are actually essentially a host for this microbiome. So there's much more of them with a much bigger influence than actually our human cells. So, yeah, when you think of it like that, you can understand how it's having that real, it's very important in the way that we're functioning as a whole organism.
And certainly when you're looking at pregnancy, but it goes far deeper than that, isn't it? It's really the evolution of yourself, really. Once you come into the world, it's you're very much driven by what your parents have been exposed to, what your parents have been eating, and then of course that formulates how does that impact then on what our own microbiome or our own gut health is going to be even before we're born.
Absolutely. So we inherit our gut microbiome from our mother, and the influence of her microbiome is greatly impacted by her environment, her family, because we tend to share the bugs. If families with pets, have shown to have a difference in their microbiome because of that exposure to the bacteria, that they have actually a healthier microbiome, which is one of those really interesting things we're learning now. We had that, we went through the stage of, you've probably heard of the hygiene hypothesis, where we had a lower exposure to bugs because we thought all bacteria was bad. So we started sterilizing everything and, stopped, we used to grow up in the dirt and kids eat dirt and play outside, and then we just had that really lessened exposure to those kind of things, and it really impacted the way our immune systems were developing. So the first exposure to bacteria is actually for the fetus is happening in pregnancy. So we used to think that the placenta was sterile and the first exposure to any kind of bacteria or sort of microbiome colonization was happening at birth. But now we see there's this translocation of bacteria across the placenta, and the research in this is very much in its infancy, but we're seeing that there's this priming of the immune system happening. So it's actually that from third trimester, it's actually starting to activate and develop the immune system of the infant.
That's just really so fascinating, because when I work a lot with Indigenous families and in very remote parts of Australia, and when I come back here and work with the families here, I'm looking at, you know, children having lots of allergies, whereas, you know, up there in the Northern Territory and anywhere else within large communities, I mean, there is no such thing as allergies. I mean, I very rarely find children, well, actually not at all, children who have an allergic reaction to food. I mean, they eat peanut butter and, you know, very early on they're in the dirt, they live together, the dogs are at, you know, sleeping with them. I mean, they have other health concerns, obviously, like scabies and otitis media. But it's just fascinating that you think, you know, we've now become this very clean society and it's impacting on our gut health. It's just so fascinating.
Absolutely. And our immune development as well. That's really important. There's a big study going on at the moment on the border of Russia and Finland, I think it is. And so the two communities are very close on either side of the border, but in Russia they still live very traditionally and they're still living, eating traditional diets and on farms and growing their own food and all that kind of stuff. And then on the other side they've got medications and hygiene and, you know, those, you know, completely different. There's a lot of interventions in birth, whereas, you know, on that other side they're still probably home birthing and that those kind of practices. And the difference in autoimmune diseases as the kids are growing up through the generation, so they're actually looking, they're following them through that, you know, that whole life, and seeing such increased incidence of autoimmune diseases in the cleaner, healthier, more medically advanced countries than they do, you know, with people still living, you know, out on farms and very rurally and naturally. So fascinating to see what's happening through all that intervention and the way we've changed our diet and medications. Stress is another very big one that comes into that changes the environment of our gut, which then changes that microbial balance. Like anything that changes the environment in our gut will impact which bugs are growing and which bugs are thriving and which ones aren't. So stress is one of the ones that really sort of encourages the overgrowth of pathogens and the sort of the bad guys, we would say, and, because of the changes it does to the gut, changes the pH, it changes the motility factors, it changes the mucous membrane integrity. So it really impacts that whole environment and then therefore the sort of the bugs that are growing.
It's just extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, it just raises so many other questions when we're thinking of, you know, medication that we're exposed to. Like, I mean, and certainly I'm also looking at the elderly, you know, who have long-term, you know, medication and who are also in aged care facilities, and what's their gut microbiome like as they're getting older. And, of course, you know, there's more medication, and we're sort of saying, and even with people with mental health conditions and even pregnant women who have got things like mental health conditions who are on antidepressants or on anti-anxiety medication. And then, of course, we're adding pregnancy on top of that. But it's not just that. It's also things like we're now looking at gestational diabetes, the impacts of that, whether or not they're on insulin or not, or even high blood pressure medication. And when I look at that whole you know, concept of all these medications, that the impact that it will have on the pregnancy, but also the impact that this have on the fetus and the development of that baby's gut health. I really don't, or the fetus followed by post-delivery, I don't think people are really very much aware of how this impacts on the child's health.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's definitely, there's a lot more research going into it now about how that's impacting the not just the health of the infant, but the pregnancy outcome. So even as far back as fertility, we're seeing that the term we use is dysbiosis, which is the imbalance in the microbiome. So that can happen in the gut or the reproductive organs, in the breast milk, and that it's having an impact across that whole life stage and that colonization into the infant. So from preconception, it can impact fertility and implantation chances, and then going through your pregnancy, it can impact pregnancy outcomes, like things like gestational diabetes has got links to having dysbiosis, preterm birth as well, any of the infection complications like GBS, that's actually a dysbiosis in the vagina flora. And then when you start to look at birth, so the other birth complications, and then pregnancy, I mean, breastfeeding complications as well, that's having a very big impact on them too, because breast milk has got its own microbiome as well. So if you've got a dysbiotic microbiome in the breast milk, then that reduces the chances of having good breastfeeding, a good healthy breastfeeding outcomes, increases the risk of getting infections like mastitis, blocked ducts, breast pain, all of those kind of things that then will can potentially then cause mums to stop breastfeeding as well. So even though when mums are breastfeeding, we can't assume that they've got an optimal breast milk flora. That's the other thing, because of all of these things that have happened through pregnancy, whether it's medication or stress or poor diet, you know, environmental toxins, all of those things are going to impact that. And so even if mums have a natural birth and then they do breastfeed, they still might have an imbalance in that microbiome because of these things that have happened through pregnancy or even before that, even preconception. Like if you look at antibiotics, they have such a big impact on our gut flora and all the flora throughout our bodies, and it can take, you know, between 2, 4, 6, up to 10 years to restore that microbiome in people, even just from one course of antibiotics, which is really, really pretty scary, because there's not many people in our civilizations that haven't had antibiotics.
Well, that's quite extraordinary, because when I look at certainly working with Indigenous families, I'm looking at, you know, the little ones who have otitis media from around about 6 months of age. You know, they're quite prone to getting otitis media. And I was actually reading an article just on, you know, the Haemophilus influenza bug, which is causing a lot of that otitis media as well in those communities. And I'm looking at them having large amounts of antibiotics, certainly very early on, from about 6 months onwards. But it's just not that. Then you've also got the rheumatic heart disease, which they're prone to, and they're on long-term penicillin, you know, they're on it for life. And what's that doing to their gut microbiome? I mean, it's just mind-blowing when I think about all these antibiotics, and certainly now knowing that, you know, you're looking at least 10 years for your gut microbiome to actually come back to some sort of normality. I mean, we've all been on antibiotics for, you know, one thing or another, you know, because of an infection or a chest infection or whatever the infection may have been. But, you know, even with probiotics, which they say that you should be using, you know, it's best to use probiotics because it'll then, otherwise you might get thrush, you know, but still that still doesn't seem to make any headway when you're looking at 10 years of your gut still being impacted by one dose of antibiotics.
And it's not always, like some people, if they've got a very good, robust ecosystem as their microflora, then they might bounce back well from one course of antibiotics. But if they've had poor diet and stress and those kind of things, it's already compromised their gut bugs, then, you know, that course is going to be harder for them to get over. But when you look at the repetitive courses of antibiotics and polypharmacy, when people are also taking maybe a diabetic medication or a protein pump inhibitor is another one of the medications now that's coming through that's having very big impacts. So they're the acid inhibitors in the gut. So actually, again, they really change the environment of the gut. And so that contributes to that the overgrowth of bad bacteria further down. So if you when you combine all the that you see the people that have got really destructive microbiomes and the ones that just that often don't bounce back, or and some of the bugs that we've had for a long term over human history we've wiped out completely, like in our affluent countries where we do have a poor diet and high stress lives and high use of antibiotics and other medications, we've got the worst diversity in our microbiomes globally. So all of those things in combination have really, and because we're now going into that second, third and fourth generation where there has been those factors playing a part, again, that's one of the reasons why a lot of our kids living in our cities have got those high allergies and eczemas and, you know, like there's so many kids that are allergic to everything. They're allergic to all the different food antigens. And I think, again, with their, so my theory with the Indigenous communities, even though they have been having antibiotics, they're not really into their fourth and, you know, third, fourth generation of that. They're really sort of in maybe their second generation still of having that high use of antibiotics. So, and they still have the benefit of living in the dirt and, you know, eating not it depends where the communities are, but a lot of people still eat some traditional foods and those kind of things. So they still have that offset a little bit, where we've just kind of had three or four generations of just trashing the microbiome. So it's kind of like, no wonder we're seeing so many health conditions and allergies and autoimmune conditions. Is that other thing that what we tend to see as people age, when they haven't been able to restore their microbiome. So I work with a lot of clients at that level where they've got a lot of food intolerances, a lot of allergies, a lot of environmental intolerances as well. Like, and then, you know, we really have to go back and try and rebuild the microbiome from the beginning.
That's it. And that's obviously going to take a long time to do that. Now, one of the other questions I had, because I don't see a lot of it, but I do see some women with that nipple vasospasm, which is really quite painful. Does that, is that also related to the gut health? Because you were talking about, you know, and what can I advise, you know, some of those women that have got nipple vasospasm, because it used to be that hot and cold and, you know, not making sure that they're exposing themselves to the cold and keeping themselves warm, which they often give up breastfeeding because of that, because it's just so painful.
We've had a few stories of mums that have had that there is an imbalance in the in the microbiome behind the nipple spasm. So it's like something that's creating an inflammation or potentially a blocked duct that's creating that sort of nerve pain. The thrush is one of those. Nipple thrush can actually cause that, because that's one of the symptoms of nipple thrush is the vasospasm as well. So we've had some really good success stories with using probiotics in those cases. So the thing about probiotics is, you need to use the right one for the right job, and that's why it's very difficult for mums and you know, just for consumers in general to know what they're doing by choosing the right one. So everybody knows probiotics are good for them. So if anyone, you know, doesn't know the definition of a probiotic is, and it being different to the microbiome. The microbiome's our indigenous flora and all the genetic material, whereas a probiotic is an isolated bacteria that's known to have a beneficial effect on the host if you take it as a supplement. So, again, that's why we've been able to develop these supplemental probiotics. We've been able to isolate the beneficial bacteria, the ones that we know have a good effect on us. But to get a good probiotic in a supplement or a bottle to take, there's a whole host of different mechanisms that bacteria has to show. And unfortunately, in our supplemental, you know, industry, they're not always good quality ones. So that can be very difficult to navigate for people, you know, like you go into a health food shop and you hope that you're buying something that's going to be good quality and manufactured well, but that's obviously not always the case. So that's the hardest thing, I think. And as health professionals, and again, that's why my role as health professional educator is actually giving that information to health professionals so they can filter that down through to the people that need to know. So, and it's definitely is about well-researched, well-produced, you know, well-manufactured companies that have got a good, you know, good ethics around their production and good research around their strains. Yeah.
And I suppose it's also too, because a lot of these women who, you know, go to the GP for, you know, for many reasons, but I mean, and you're quite rightly, you know, providing education to those health professionals and the importance of, you know, the right probiotic, because I myself would not have known about the right probiotic, and I would have just said, look, you know, just go and get yourself, if you're on taking antibiotics, make sure that you're going to the chemist and asking for an appropriate probiotic. But I mean, that again depends on whether or not the pharmacist and or the pharmacist potentially, but also the people working in the pharmacy, who are often casual employees and or who are young people who may not have all of that knowledge, or who may have been away when the health education may have been provided. So that again presents a dilemma.
Yeah, it's one of our challenges. And the other big one is that the TGA in Australia doesn't require us to label the strain on the probiotic. So you may have heard of like a probiotic, Lactobacillus acidophilus. That's the yogurt strain that everybody's heard of. So there's actually thousands of different strains of those Lactobacillus acidophilus, and not all of them are going to be, you know, good quality, effective, you know, doing the right job. So the TGA doesn't support the industry, or it doesn't police the industry to have good quality things or strains in there that have been researched to actually be effective. So that's another big barrier as well, or big, you know, hurdle for people to get over. So again, it's if for consumers and for health professionals, it's always good to try and get someone to go into a health food shop or get the advice of someone who has been educated. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we try and do, and we're doing a lot of it this year through our companies, educating in pharmacies at that level, because that's where most people are going in and getting their probiotics from. And if you get the right probiotic, it can have an amazing effect on outcomes. It really can help in that short term to get you over those hurdles of maybe breast pain or mastitis or blocked ducts or some IBS symptoms or a UTI in pregnancy, let's say. Like, a lot of women get treated with recurring UTIs in pregnancy, and they get antibiotics after antibiotics after antibiotics, and then, you know, then their chances of having an intervention through birth, and then their breastfeeding complications are increased by already having that, you know, that imbalance. So if you can get a probiotic in at the right time, you can really, really change those outcomes. And so you can increase their chances of having a good breastfeeding story, of having good breast milk flora. Then that's going to pass on to the infant, so they're going to have good flora going in and colonizing their gut. So they're going to have a better development of the immune system, of the digestive system, less chances of having food intolerances, less chances of having colic and reflux and all of those things that are really problematic in infancy. And then ideally you're going to optimize that development of the immune system, which is going to impact that infant for life. So I think that's why I love being able to do this in this life stage, because that's when we can have the most influence for the longest term. So if we get that right through pregnancy, birth, breastfeeding and early colonization, then we're going to set that infant up for much better health outcomes over their lifetime.
And I would agree with you. I mean, I've always said to, you know, lots of families that I've worked with, you know, it's that importance of early nutrition, you know, well before you plan to get pregnant, potentially a year before you plan to get pregnant, is looking at changing some of your dietary habits and, you know, cutting out some of the foods that you enjoy very much, but, you know, may not be doing your gut any sort of good in the long run. I mean, not that I knew about all of the information that I've certainly learnt in the last couple of months, and certainly, you know, it sort of substantiates what I've been saying, you know, to a lot of the women. I mean, we're offering them things like Elevit and all of those, you know, pregnancy vitamins, you know, prior to pregnancy. But it is about, you know, they're meant to start at 3 months beforehand. But my biggest concern is, of course, heading back up to, you know, WA and going into a very remote community. You know, I know that a lot of those women don't take Elevit, you know, so I'm looking at some sort of challenges that I'm going to be faced with trying to, you know, look at what can I do from my point of view just to improve some of that nutrition, you know, during pregnancy, and hoping to improve. And I mean, they all breastfeed, you know, which is a good thing. There's only a few women that would potentially bottle feed, but all of them will breastfeed right up until the age of two. You know, my biggest concern usually is just introducing solids, but I am looking at, you know, that those generations of, you know, what can we do to assist them to just to decreasing some of those, you know, lots of other challenges, of course, you know, having antibiotics. And of course, you know, they do have other concerns as well. But you know, it's important for me to sort of, you know, ensure that these families, you know, from a health point of view, and you're quite right, it is about introducing the education about good nutrition prior to getting pregnant. Yeah. You know.
Absolutely. And one of the things, and as I've mentioned to you, I do go up and do some education in the Indigenous communities as well, like up in the Kimberleys too. And one of my biggest focuses is on how to get them to eat more plant foods, because plant foods are the things that support a healthy microbiome. And in our standard Australian diet, we eat a lot of processed carbohydrates and high sugars, and they're the things that feed the bad guys, essentially. So it's about trying to shift that carbohydrate group of food from the processed white high sugar things back to, you know, very plant food based stuff like fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds. I always encourage people to have herbs and spices and those kinds of things because they're so nutrient dense and they're easy to add to foods. And one of the things that we did up in Fitzroy Crossing was we did a 4-week healthy eating program because one of the biggest barriers, there's a few barriers out in those communities, availability, affordability, storage, you know, those kind of things. So, you know, working on ways to get over those things, but education around the fact that, you know, white rice, white bread, noodles, those kind of things are basically sugar when you put them into your body. Whereas if you change that to vegetables, fruit, nuts, seeds, those kind of things, and affordability wasn't always an issue. So we did the 4-week program where I bought all of the food from within the community resources. And it was essentially swapping out that processed food group with vegetables. And so I was buying whatever was on special and then turning that into food, which is the way that we used to eat. We used to eat by what was seasonal and affordable and available, and then we turn that into food. Whereas now, and this is a global epidemic, you know, we just go, oh, well, I want to eat this, or, you know, I feel like something, so I'm just going to go and buy that. And it's a completely different way of eating. So trying to encourage people to go back to that and know what to do with food, because it's a lost art. It's a bit of a lost art. We've, you know, lost that in the last few generations of knowing how to get that food that's available, turn it into something that's edible but also enjoyable, and, you know, that we share and that supports us, nourishes us, those kind of things. So, yeah, it is a challenge, but, and I think we all face it, and we face it as much in our cities and things as we do. We don't have that availability problem here. We've almost got too much availability, you know. There's too much choice and too much junk food and too much, you know, over-nutrition of sugary, sort of calorie-rich, nutrient-poor foods when we really need to change it back the other way.
I certainly agree with you. And I think, you know, when we can have, God forbid me even mentioning it, you know, McDonald's, who can offer, you know, the 50-cent burger or the dollar burger, and, you know, it just sort of, and looking for some of those families, you know, that's all they can afford, you know, because they, and you're quite right, you know, we are looking at environmental concerns as well, you know, is where they live and how they live. You know, they might live in a dwelling, but they have no connected, you know, services. They may have hot water, or they may have water, but they may not have a functional, they may have a stove, but it may not be working. So so there's a whole,
there's no storage of food. So you can't, one of the other easy things to do with cooking is buying what's on special, and then, you know, so it's cheap when it's available, but then if you can't store it, you don't always have that option. One of the things that I used to, one of the big examples that I think would make a big impact to people is that when the vegetables were in season, they were cheaper. So like when I was up there one time, cabbages were $1 each. So a whole cabbage is a really good vegetable. And it's also, so I was going to mention prebiotics. So you've probably, when we're talking about probiotics, so prebiotics are the fibers in food that actually feed our good bacteria. And so they're actually even more important in that long term to restore the good bacteria. That's how we do it. And that's, it's in all our different plant foods, obviously. But so a cabbage is $1 and a bag of rice is, you know, $2.50 or $2.80. So it's actually cheaper to buy a cabbage, but you need to know what to do with it and how to feed the family with it as well. So that's, again, one of the things I try to do in the education is how to use these vegetables. And cauliflowers at one point were $1, you know. When they're not in season up there, they're $7. So it's certainly is about, you know, shopping to what's available and affordable.
And that's always been a challenge. Doesn't matter, you know, which part of the country you go to, you know, certainly, you know, I mean, I've worked up in the Torres Strait and it was exactly the same. You know, we all waited for the boat to come in to provide us the fresh, you know, fruit and veg, but, you know, because it was cheap there and then. But I mean, I think, you know, you're quite right. It's so easy just to purchase, you know, prepackaged food, you know, the white bread and the rice and, you know, and the pasta and, you know, and the 2-minute noodles. Well, they're a lot easier to prepare, and because all you need is hot water, and you can always boil a billy, you know, to get the hot water going.
Everybody's got used to that too, and, you know, like that then becomes the norm. That's what the kids have been eating, and that's what they've grown up eating. And yeah, so we, I would see a lot of there's sort of a much more of awareness now around sugar and soft drink and, you know, those kind of things, which there wasn't, you know, sort of 10, 15 years ago, especially in the community that I've worked in up there, you know, that everyone was still drinking cool drink, not knowing what impact that was having. Whereas now they're certainly coming, you know, have more of an understanding around that. Some of the stuff that we did up in Fitzroy was put up some posters around the service stations and the in the supermarket, labelling how much sugar was in things, because people just don't know. That's not something that they think about, you know. They just go...
Well, that's quite right, you know, and all those visual, you know, they're much easier to look at, you know, if there's 20, I think it was about 20 teaspoons of sugar in a can of Coke or something, or in a bottle of Mountain Dew or something. Mountain Dew, I think, was a lot more than 20, you know.
Yeah, but we did that in there, and we did how many teaspoons are in each bottle as well, so to encourage people to choose the smaller one. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's, you know, like things like that, rather than, you know, grab the big 1.25 bottles all the time. And I mean, ideally you'd like to see, you know, other choices be available. And that's the other thing I did working with the stores up there, is trying to promote the healthier choices being available, and not just labeling things saying this is really bad, but also we had red and green labels. So we'd do the red labels that had a lot of sugar, and then the green labels that had less than a certain amount that, you know, were better choices, and trying to promote positive change rather than just saying, you know, well, we shouldn't have that. And that goes for everyone, you know. That's how I work with clients all the time, you know. It's not just about you can't eat this, it's like, let's eat more of this, and let's do it in a way that, you know, that tastes good, and that, you know, and again, encouraging that healthy relationship with food again that we've certainly, you know, lost to a great extent through all of our sort of population groups.
So moving forward, really, from certainly from my perspective, but also from being a health professional, is what things do you think that, you know, would benefit most when I talk to families about, you know, something that's going to resonate quite well with them, besides, you know, the messages of not so much processed food, and, you know, trying to look at, you know, some more fresh fruits. And of course, like you mentioned before, you know, what's in season. But how, just some additional sort of food for thought, you know, pardon the pun, but how to, you know, incorporate that into families understanding a little bit more about their own sort of gut health, and take a little bit more notice of what it is that they're eating. But it was also certainly for the babies, because, you know, you mentioned before about colic and reflux and all those sort of things, and which brought me to think about, you know, what about our bottle fed babies? You know, what's happening for their gut microbiome? So I'm really asking a couple of questions here. So
I think one of the easiest things when you're talking to families that can make it tangible and doable is that we aim for 30 different serves of plant foods a week. So that's something that people can quantify, you know, like they can actually go, oh, well, so, and because the diversity across those plant food groups is what creates a good and healthy diversity in our microbiome. So if we can, and I encourage people to write it down. We all know that we should be eating more fruits and vegetables, so but encouraging diversity by going, instead of just eating green apples every day, one day have a green apple, one day have a pink, one day have a red, and that creates diversity. So nuts, seeds, herbs and spices are another easy way to add plant food diversity into your meals and family, and you can hide things as well in with, you know, for kids and fussy eaters, because mums with newborns are often, the diet comes last, and the diet's so important in that stage to optimize breast milk, you know, quality and energy and, you know, all of those things when they're under stress and those kind of things. So trying to find easy ways that you can actually sort of incorporate more diversity and nutrient density without having to overhaul your whole diet. So, and focusing on what things to include rather than going, I'm not allowed to eat that, I'm not allowed to eat that, oh my god, what should I eat, you know, like then maybe just rather putting extra nutrients on top, I find an easy way for people to do it. And the second question about the formula fed infants, so it does greatly change their gut bacteria in those, particularly in those early stages. So when we look at exclusively breastfed babies, they actually have a low diversity in that first sort of 6 to 12 months which is that's how it's meant to be. So there's a increase in bifidobacteria. These are the ones that are interacting with the immune system, and because the infants are born with such a immature digestive system, but not just the digestive system, it's also the immune system and the central nervous system. And so the role of breast milk through those stages is to help those developmental processes happen. So by giving artificial formulas, then it is greatly changing that development, and that's what we tend to see, that increase in allergies and autoimmune disease, those kind of things. So, but you can do things for those infants. You certainly can add some probiotics into the formula. So that's a really good time to be doing that. And then really focus on what you're introducing when you start to introduce solids, because that's going to have a really big impact on that development of their gut bacteria. So the formula fed infants have a greater diversity in their microbiome earlier, which that then can impact that immune development. So we use pre and probiotics in the formulas, and that can really help sort of, we can't mimic our human breast milk, but we're trying to. The formulas are getting better these days. They come now with some prebiotics in them, and they can't put probiotics in them at this stage because they're not stable enough, so you wouldn't be able to actually just mix it up, but you can definitely get some that you can add into the formula that's going to help with that immune development and reduce the chances of having colic and reflux and those kind of things, because colic and reflux, the babies are getting treated with those acid inhibitors a lot of the time, and it's not necessarily a sign of too much acid, it's a real sign of an immature digestive system. So if you can help the development of that digestive system with the good bacteria and the prebiotics, then, that's going to end up as a better result in the long term. And quite often those medications take 3 to 4 weeks to work anyway. So, in my opinion, you'd be much better off doing that, because you're just creating another problem with, if you're reducing acid. They're supposed to have acid in their gut. It's just coming into the wrong spot, So just reducing the acid causes downstream problems. So I would recommend, if available, to go and talk to a health professional about what the best formulas would be, how you can introduce some prebiotics and probiotics into those formulas as well.
And I think that's the difficulty too, when families get so distressed, and especially when the baby does have colic or reflux, and certainly the GP then puts them on medication, as you quite rightly mentioned, and then of course they go to the chemist and they look at some formula, because that's the other alternative. And so you're dealing with a young person who may not understand the makeup of those formulas and what the requirements are of that infant. And and there's such a broad variety of formulas. You've got the S26 Gold, you've got the plain S26, you've got NAN, it's just never endless. And I, unless I stand there and look at all the formula, what's in them, I don't recommend formulas anyway, because it's got to be suitable for the infant. One formula may not suit that particular infant. So, and Gold may not be, the formula suitable for that little one. It might be just way too heavy.
It's very individual. And again, it's like, if you can work with a health professional that has an understanding of gut flora and pre and probiotics and those kind of things, and if you can get to mums when they're still breastfeeding, even if there is reflux or colic, we can also work on the composition of that breast milk, of the probiotics and by using probiotics that actually get into the breast milk. And again, that's where the education, the webinar that you've watched, that I provide to health professionals, midwives, lactation consultants, those kind of people who are on the front line with mums that are having breastfeeding complications. By getting the right probiotic in at that time, you can really, you can reduce the colic and the reflux symptoms quite quickly. And also eczema and those kind of things, like the skin rashes in the babies and the nappy rash. We've got a photo of a baby that one of our LCs sent us. I think it's in the case study of the webinar that you watched. I might have added it later, but this baby had a really bad nappy rash, and mum was breastfeeding, but she was having latch issues, and so the LC was working with her for that. So she was improving the breastfeeding, but the baby still had this rash, and the mum didn't realise that wasn't normal. So anyway, the LC gave her some probiotics, and within 3 days that rash had cleared up. I bought her an after photo and it was so amazing. And so if she hadn't got onto that probiotic, the rash probably would have continued, you know, that indicates is the rash was caused by an imbalance in the flora, either in the breast milk or in the baby's gut. So, you know, that connection. So if that hadn't been treated with just a simple probiotic, but using the right probiotic, then that dysbiosis may have, you know, turned into something worse, or, you know, then created an allergic, you know, because a lot of mums get told the babies are allergic to their breast milk. And I just don't think that, you know, that... When I hear that, I just go, oh God, who's saying these things? But anyway, we can fix, you know, we can help improve the composition of the breast milk, and then we can keep mums breastfeeding. And that's my ultimate goal, because I think that's how we get the best health outcomes, is we improve mum's health, mum's breast milk flora, and then obviously, you know, that we keep mum's breastfeeding, and then we improve the outcomes for the bubs as well.
It's just amazing. I mean, I just look at it and, you know, it's just, I'm just in awe, because I'm sort of thinking, you know, there's so many things that, you know, we can do without having to, you know, send them off to the GP to then provide medication. And even with introducing solids, you know, it's the same thing. You know, I talk to the families about, you know, introducing solids, introducing them at the right time, you know, looking at that. Certainly from my point of view, it's very much about the iron content in the food and just making sure that they're getting lots of iron, because it's so important. But it's also offering that diversity and offering, you know, those oral motor skills, all of those developments, because they're just incredibly important. I mean, I've seen 10, 11 month old babies who are still eating purees, and, you know, world babies, you know, it's just you know, so vast that you think to yourself, you know, this poor little one is not developing all these skills that we want them to develop. And then but yeah, it's just very
much confusion too out there for mums as well. Like it's hard to get the right information, and with the old Dr. Google and the internet, and, you know, like there's so much information, it's almost information overload. And again, one of the things I do talk to about with my health professionals are educating mums, but directly with the mums themselves about using their instinct and, you know, like looking for the cues, like you say, like the developmental cues that tell you that the baby's ready or not ready, and those kind of things as well, which again, you know, it's one of those sort of lost arts, or, you know, one of the things that there's a lot of confusion around. And so many mums have bad stories, and they have, you know, even from pregnancy and birth, there's so much fear around that. And I definitely encourage my mums to do, you know, the birth classes that can really help, you know, the calm births and the hypnobirthing and those kind of things that just really help mums have a better experience, you know, and less interventions through their birthing experience. Because I think the more intervention, the further away we get from a natural birth, which, you know, we were as women born to do, you know, the more health complications we end up with.
Mm. Oh, I agree with you. And I think it's taking that step back and getting back to, you know, yes, you're right, Dr. Google, we have all that information available. And yes, and I agree 100%, information overload, and the parents do get confused about, you know, what they need to do. And they do want answers, because, you know, certainly if their baby's upset, or if they're upset or get upset stomachs. And I think it's about understanding your own health. And I think, you know, one of the important things is that for women and anyone really is important to understand their own health, and how they can help themselves understand their own health, because then would then ultimately provide a better health outcome for both, for the whole family, really. And I think that's what we're really, I think it's what we're really missing, those sort of, you know, very down to earth, you know, very normal health messages that we used to have. You know, yes, eating your fruit and veggies, and, you know, and eat what's in season. I mean, you don't eat cherries that are out of season, because they're imported and, you know, very expensive. So yeah, I think it's really important that we get back to those very basics.
Yeah, and the more close we can get back to, you know, yeah, like the seasonal eating, the natural foods, local foods, knowing where your food comes from, those kind of things. And also our healthcare system needs reform. And that, I think a lot of confusion comes through that, because, you know, the mums or dads or anyone going to the doctor, and the doctors are treating a symptom rather than looking for a cause of an ill. And it's nobody the healthcare system has been set up, and that's how it works. And, you know, pharmaceutical medications are given to treat a symptom, and then, you know, but then often that symptom creates another problem, or that medication creates another problem. So that's one of the other things I think we can educate parents about, is making informed decisions about what they're giving themselves and their children. I think that's really important as well. And it's so, and again, Dr. Google can create more confusion than your original question. So again, finding health professionals that are educated and have an understanding of, you know, the gut health, the microbiome, how certain medications are going to impact that, you know, can be very helpful too. So trying to get the right information to the people that need it at the right time. It's a big challenge for health professionals, you know, with people getting conflicting advice, it is difficult. But again, that's why we do these things, and we have these conversations, and we try and get that information out there. And, you know, and that, I love working with midwives and LCs, because they're just such an awesome group of people, so passionate about trying to have bringing new humans into the world is such an amazing thing to be part of, and helping new mums or any mums have good experiences is really rewarding. So,
and that's quite true. You know, I certainly hear a lot of do a lot of home visits, and the mums are sort of saying, oh, you know, they've got all this conflicting advice, and, you know, which you hear and I hear all the time. But it's about, you know, I just sort of say, well, you know, it's the advice that works for you, and you work with, you know, what's going to work for you. It's not going to work for me, but it's really, this is your baby and your family, and it's got to work for you as a family. So and it's always a challenge, isn't it?
Yes.
But we're almost out of time. Is there anything else that, you know, from a point of view from the gut micro, some final thoughts on gut microbiomes and some just a final message that you'd like to share with us?
I think overall, if you're looking at as health professionals trying to give the right information, the key messages really need to be that for long-term health of the microbiome, for mums, for babies, for families, for, you know, for everybody, is really diet and lifestyle. So it's diet and lifestyle that has the biggest long-term. So things like having lots of, you know, the pre and you can actually eat the foods that have got the probiotics in there as well, like your fermented foods and things like that. So having a healthy, balanced whole food diet, lifestyle is really important. So if there's continual stress and, you know, those kind of things, that has to be addressed. If there's poor sleep, then that creates a big stress on the body. That needs to be addressed. So they're the lifestyle factors that really are going to have an impact. And then medications is another big one. So being, you know, so thinking of diet, stress and medications as the three key players for long-term health of the microbiome. And then when you're trying to help manage something in the acute stages, like breastfeeding or, you know, pregnancy, you know, like improving the health of the microbiome in the short term to improve that outcome, then probiotics are so, so key, but it's got to be the right one. Otherwise they don't necessarily do what you want them to do. And that's, again, it's getting the right advice. So short-term use of manipulation of the microbiome to improve health outcomes is all about probiotics. And then the long-term, you know, health that we need to look at for having healthy aging and, you know, disease prevention for ourselves and our families really is those three things, a diet, lifestyle and reducing our use on medications.
Mm, all right. Thank you. Thank you very much for taking the time to provide some understanding on the probiotics and microbiomes and really what's going on in our gut, but more importantly, how we can improve our health, not just our own health, but also the health of our children. And yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Happy to share. I'm really passionate about the topic, and I do really think that we can, you know, make some really positive changes if we get this message out.
And I think it's also about working together. You know, we always talk about collaboratively working together and professionals working together, but it doesn't always happen. You know, people work very much in isolation and in silos. And, you know, I'm very much for, you know, the more information I can provide to others and the more I can share with others, It's not about me having all the keeper of all the knowledge. It's about everyone having the knowledge that we can all work with.
Share as much as we can. That's one of the great things about being able to use this digital platform is that we can, you know, share it with more people. Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, I'm more than happy to share. I've, you know, got lots of lists about pre and probiotic foods and those kind of things. So I don't know if you want to, if you put, like, you know, PDF resources on your website and those kind of things. But I've got, I'm more than happy to share any of those if you think that would be beneficial, like a handout that you could give to mum that's got all that probiotic foods listed on it. You know, that's one of the things I give out a lot. So, you know, any of that stuff I'm happy to share.
That'd be certainly quite helpful, certainly from a practice point of view, because I, like I said, I see lots of families who, you know, are struggling with breastfeeding, then they'll get mastitis and then they'll, you know, they go to the doctor and they get their antibiotics. But I mean, nobody else to, and I do talk to them about, you know, yes, you need to take something in order to make sure that, you know, your gut isn't being affected. But now that I know that there is, you know, the right probiotic or a probiotic that's going to work a lot better for them, you know, that's certainly going to be helpful from my point of view, but also getting that message out there to the rest of my colleagues, which will be great.
Yeah, absolutely. And we can, and we'll be doing webinars every couple of months as new research comes out in that whole probiotic field. This year, ACM's partnered with us to get that education module out through hospitals, universities. We're doing lots of the conference. We're doing pre-conference workshops and evening workshops nationally this year, which will be great. So if people are interested in learning more about that sort of, you know, the probiotics and the research behind that and, you know, expanding on the things, the topics we talked about today about, you know, different medications and that kind of stuff, then if they follow on that, it will be listed on the Kiara website, on the Kiara social media, and then also on the ACM website, they'll have the list of all the workshops and the webinar links as well. So,
oh, that'd be great!
Good way to access sort of more detailed information about it.
All right, that'd be great. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for all that insight into today. Thank you.